Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guests.
Thank you, Sarah. This is Bob Keebler, and I'm here today with Anna Moody and David O'Neill to talk about the Kaysner case. Welcome, Anna. Tell us what the Supreme Court said will determine whether a state can tax a trust in the future.
Thanks, Bob. Well, the decision was very narrow, and so in our case, it determined that the state taxation regime was unconstitutional. But it's very narrowly tailored to the facts of our case. In making its decision, the court found that where a trustee has absolute discretion and a contingent beneficiary received no distributions, the fact of the contingent beneficiary's residence alone is insufficient to support taxation. The court focused really in on the core questions of possession and control. So whose money is it really? Who was controlling the money? Who could bind the trust property? Did the resident beneficiary actually receive any money? And who was making the decisions about how the money could be used? Here, in our case, the trustee had absolute discretion over the trust property, the trust assets, which the court found to be determinative when the beneficiary was not actually certain to receive any distributions at any time. In the future, we can expect these same issues, possession and control, to be determinative, I think.
So after this decision, what states' laws are open to challenge? Meaning, what states will CPAs probably file amended returns in or protective claims? How's that going to look going forward?
Well, certainly any state law that relies exclusively on a contingent beneficiary's residence is going to be open to challenge, but there are only a tiny handful of those. Tennessee, which is getting rid of its income tax anyhow in the near future, possibly Georgia, though there's some debate about that. We think the opinion leaves open a challenge to any law that taxes parties who don't actually possess or control the trust property, including laws that look to in-state residency as one of a combination of factors, like in California potentially, and settler-based laws like the one at issue in the Fielding case.
So let's go over to David. In what situations should trustees seek a refund based on the Kaysner decision or alternatively sue the state if they don't provide a timely refund?
I think there are several situations in which CPAs will want to think very carefully and seriously about filing claims for a refund. The first and most obvious one is where a state taxed the trust based on connections to the beneficiary. If the only connection to the beneficiary was the fact that the beneficiary lived there and that beneficiary didn't receive any money or have the right to receive any money, you'd want to file a refund in that situation. It becomes more complicated when the connections that the state based its tax on are with the trustee or with the settlor. As Anna noted earlier, the pivotal issue in these decisions going forward is going to be control and possession. And the fundamental question that states will need to ask is, did the state provide any ongoing value to the trust in the year in which it sought to tax the trust? If the state taxed the trust based on connections to the trustee, those connections need to be ongoing and they need to be valid in the year in which the tax was imposed. If the state taxed on the basis of connections with a settlor, for the same reasons, those connections with the settlor need to be ongoing and the state needed to provide some value to the trust in the year in which it was taxed. So in any situation where a CPA looks at a trust and its relationship with the state that imposed the tax, and there is no practical ongoing connection between that state and the trust, the CPA will want to file a refund, and if the state denies it, there will be a good case there that could go to court.
Now, the way I understand this is there are claims for refund where you're actually saying send me a check for the taxes I've paid in. And then there are protective claims where you're saying the law might develop here, or my facts might develop, or I can't exactly compute my refund right now, but I want to leave the statute open. Is there a difference in approach between states? For example, I think what I'm hearing is Georgia and Tennessee, it's easy to say to file a refund and to see what happens. Maybe Tennessee easier than Georgia. Certainly North Carolina's directly in that situation. But what about other states where you're waiting for something to happen with Fielding, or you're waiting for something else to happen at the Supreme Court level?
Certainly there's going to be a core of situations and states, Georgia, Tennessee, in which you'd want to just claim for the refund right now, because any tax based on a beneficiary's connections that's similar to the one in Kaysner, the state really doesn't have a defense there. As you get further out from that core and you start to look at situations that the court either didn't address in Kaysner or made clear it was specifically not addressing in Kaysner, and there are a number of situations that the court was careful to carve out of its opinion, that's a situation in which you'd want to put in a protective claim and then wait to see how the litigation plays out, see how the courts treat Kaysner, and see what happens with Fielding, which obviously is a key question in the wake of Kaysner.
Dave, that's very insightful. What about the situation where we're beyond the state statute of limitations? So say the statute was 4 years. We're talking about years way beyond that. Do we file claims for refund? Do we file amended returns?
Well, this was a constitutional case. And so what the Supreme Court said was that the statute under which the Kaysner Trust had been taxed was unconstitutional and invalid. And that meant that any money the state had taken under that statute was, in the court's words, an unjust confiscation of property. In the same way that if someone were convicted under a criminal law, it would be an unjust deprivation of that person's liberty. So there's a good argument that even if a claim goes beyond the statute of limitations under the state's laws, that if the statute is either unconstitutional under Kaysner or is suspect under Kaysner, that the claim should go back for years beyond the state's statute of limitations, because if that statute is in fact constitutionally invalid, then the state did not have a basis to take any money from the taxpayer under that statute for any period of time.
No, thank you, Dave. And just, you know, my thought on that is if you're a CPA that has to file beyond the statute of limitations, you probably want to, you certainly want to involve tax counsel in that state, ideally someone that maybe worked for the Department of Revenue in that state, and talk to them about exactly how you frame this out in the claim for refund, because you want to raise all these issues. And you're because you may end up some back in federal court having a federal court order the state to issue that refund. Dave, this decision was only good for the taxpayer. Are there things the Supreme Court said that states will use to defend the taxation of trusts?
I think there are. We had taken the broader position that the court did not adopt, that only the trustee's connections to the state make any difference for the constitutionality of the statute. And the Supreme Court didn't agree with that position. It said that you have to look at the connections and take a practical, realistic view of whether there are any meaningful relationships between the beneficiary and the state, or the trustee and the state, and the settlor and the state. And so what the state is going to do, what states are going to do based on this decision, is that they are going to try to look for any connections they can find between any one of those three trust constituents, and cite Kaysner for the proposition that such a connection justifies the tax. So there are things in this opinion that are certainly good for the taxpayer. The ultimate outcome is very good for the taxpayer, but there are also aspects of this that the state will use in its favor.
Well, thank you, Dave. Anna, what is likely to be the next big case in this area?
We expect those to be the cases based on the seller-based laws. Some states have trusts on the basis of the residence of the settler when the trust became irrevocable. So if the settler was living in the state at the time the settler signed a trust agreement making setting up an irrevocable trust, then the state where the settler lives claims tax on the trust income. It's easy to draw parallels between the reasoning of those settler-based laws and the decision in the Kastner case. Under the same principles of possession and control, trust can argue that the settler doesn't have either of those things, and therefore the connection between the state and the trust is too tenuous to support the tax. Again, the facts of the individual cases are going to be important, but we think this is really the closest parallel to our case.
No, thank you. So what is the significance? Three judges or justices, including the Chief Justice, concurred with the case. What does that mean, and why is it so important?
The concurring opinion is significant because one of the noteworthy aspects of the Kastner decision is how many times the court went out of its way in footnotes or in sentences in the opinion to say we're not deciding and we're not deciding that, and to carve out a lot of issues. What the concurrence did was to say, there are cases out there that have already been decided, that have already addressed those questions that the court says it's not addressing today. And nothing in the court's opinion should be viewed as walking back the holdings of those previous cases. Now, of course, the concurrence only got the votes of three justices. So it's going to be an open question, I think, whether some of those previous cases are still fully valid, given that the majority opinion did not endorse what appears to be the holding of each of those opinions in full.
So we're going to have to wait for the next case to understand that. What do you think the Supreme Court will do with Fielding? And maybe give us a little background on Fielding, because we're getting back to what Anna talked about, settler-based laws.
The Fielding case comes out of Minnesota, and as Anna was mentioning, this is one of those cases where the state taxed the trust based on connections to the settler. Here, the fact that the settler lived in Minnesota at the time that the trust became irrevocable. The two cases, Kastner and Fielding, went up to the Supreme Court at about the same time. Kastner went in a little bit earlier. Fielding, the petition, followed soon after. The court granted the Kastner case, and Fielding has just been sitting there while the court has been considering Kastner. As Anna said, Fielding presents exactly the question that the courts are going to have to grapple with in the wake of Kastner. And we will know very soon how the Supreme Court thinks that the Kastner case affects Fielding, because the Fielding petition has been pending now for many months. It is typical after the court decides a case in the area of another case with a petition that's pending to do one of two things. Either the court will just deny the petition outright, or it will do something called grant, vacate, and remand, or in Supreme Court parlance, GVR. When the court grants, vacates, and remands, it does exactly that. It grants the petition, it vacates the decision below, and it remands to the court that decided it and essentially says, do this over in light of the opinion that we just issued in a related area. If the court decides to deny the petition, that's a strong signal that the Supreme Court does not think that the reasoning of Kastner directly applies to the settler-based laws. If, on the other hand, the Supreme Court GVRs Fielding and sends it back to the Minnesota Supreme Court, then I think that's a strong signal that the court believes that what it said in Kastner does impact those laws. And if it goes back to the Minnesota Supreme Court, that court will be the first to address the effect of Kastner on the more than dozen laws around the country that base taxation on the residency of the settler. And we'll know that very soon. The court did not act on the Fielding petition in the orders list that was issued on Monday of this week. But any day now, we should see Fielding either on the grant, vacate, and remand part of the orders list or on the petition denied.
Dave, what's your perspective on how CPAs should proceed? We've defined that some CPAs should be filing claims for refund, formal claims saying, show me the money. Other CPAs should be filing formal claims even beyond the statute. And finally, some CPAs will be filing protective claims, both within the statute and outside the statute. But I know if I was doing this, I would want a tax litigator to look at this and help me with it, and probably someone who knows very little about tax but a lot about constitutional law. Can you just frame that out for us and give us kind of your how you would approach this?
That's exactly right, Bob. Two things are clear after the Kaysner decision. The first is these are complicated issues that are going to turn very much on the specific facts of the case. And second, these are constitutional issues. They come up in the tax context, but ultimately they're about constitutional litigation. So it would be very wise, I think, for CPAs who are filing claims, particularly where the dollar amounts justify it, not only to consult with a tax law lawyer who's familiar with the specific state's procedures, but also to include from the very beginning a litigator, because everything that's submitted in support of a claim, every interaction with the state becomes evidence that will ultimately play a very important role in how that case is ultimately determined by the courts.
That's very helpful. So let me try to bottom line this, see if I get this right. If you were in Georgia or Tennessee or North Carolina, it certainly North Carolina, filing a claim for refund might be very, very straightforward. Now, I think even in North Carolina, if you're within the statute, I would wait a month or so because they're going to have to, their procedures have to get from their Department of Justice through their Department of Revenue all the way down to the person opening the mail. So that's not going to happen in 20 minutes. Tennessee and Georgia might be a little bit more difficult because they're going to try to distinguish themselves from the Kaysner case. So at that level, I begin involving tax counsel and up to tax counsel, but have somebody that might be able to eventually litigate this in state court, take a good look at that. So, Dave, is that, I mean, I know I kind of said what you said in different words, but is that a reasonable approach?
Yes. Certainly in the states that are just like North Carolina and North Carolina itself, the claims will be more straightforward. But in any state where the state is going to try to distinguish Kaysner, might go to litigation, you really do want to consult with a litigator at the outset in order to help frame the claims, in order to help frame the arguments, because the way that the claim is framed at the very beginning often determines how the case comes out. And we can expect that states are going to continue to try to fight this. This is a source of revenue to the states. They're not going to give in easily. These cases can be won, but you need the right strategy and you need to consult with the people who are ultimately going to have to make the arguments to the judges when the case does go to court.
David Anna, this has been very insightful. On behalf of the PFP section, this has been Bob Keebler with David O'Neill and Anna Moody, the lawyers that litigated the Kaysner case. If you enjoyed this podcast, we highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website and access additional information. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find these valuable resources. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.